Okay, so it looks like it's recording. It's July 23rd, 2015. My name's Rachel Gelfand, and...
My name is Park Cannon.
So, do you want to say your current position?
I currently work at the Feminist Women's Health Center as a program coordinator, and I also work as a health advocate.
So it just basically begins with a little bit, tell me a little bit about your background. The first question is, what do you remember about your grandparents on either side? So you could go into that, or you could just say, where you came from.
Cool. I grew up in Albany, Georgia. That is 3 hours south of where we are right now in Atlanta. And that's a very rural area where it's segregated. So there's like a black side of town, and then there is the KKK side of town. I grew up more on the KKK side of town just because my dad was in the military and he wanted us to be at really good schools and speak really proper and say, he never wanted us to say yes, ma'am, and all that kind of country stuff. He wanted us to just speak as if we were in the military. So that's what we did. It's my brother and I. He's 2 years older than I am, and he lives in Vermont. He's a New Englander. So I guess after living in Albany, Georgia, going to school there, definitely experiencing a good amount of racist stuff. Like, I vividly remember the Confederate flag flying around and some people in our neighborhood being uncomfortable with it because there were kids around, and it was just a weird kind of white privilege patriotic thing going on. It wasn't like we are celebrating the Civil War. It was like we actually don't like black people. So we moved to New York. We moved to Brooklyn, and that's where I grew up mostly. So I spent about 10 years living in Brooklyn, New York, and that was totally different. Like, I literally learned my first curse words there, and I was dealing with all these urban kids who are just mixes of like Puerto Rican and black or Italian and Greek, and helped me better understand that people are made up of so many different types and it's not just white or black. So that was really nice. We actually lived with my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, in Brooklyn. And they would take me to school every day. My grandfather was a taxi cab driver who liked to gamble. And my grandmother loved to go to church and cook. Those are pretty much the two main things. Unfortunately, they both passed away, like, within the past 5 years. My grandmother became severely confused by dementia, and that went into Alzheimer's. And so my grandfather was her caretaker, but he actually had a heart attack before she died. So it seems as though there was probably a lot going on with him taking care of her that was so stressful that he literally ended up just like dead in the apartment, and she didn't know for like 7 days. She had no clue. She just walked around, and I know, it was weird. When the police found his body, it was ridiculous. They had to fumigate the entire, like, half floor of the apartment complex and remove my grandma. But she didn't know. And she had not eaten for those 7 days, and she was in perfect health. So my family is very Baptist religious, mainly because they grew up in the South, so they think that God kept her. I think it was just her spirit. She's awesome. Yeah.
Not eating for 7 days is pretty...
Yeah.
Hardcore. So you remember them as sort of a kid hanging out in Brooklyn?
I do. They were very influential in my childhood. They actually... My mom has revealed to me recently that they were very sure that my mom was the better parent of my mom and my dad. And so they wanted to make sure that we were with my mom and that she had custody of us. So they did everything that they could to have us move there, be safe. My mom even shared with me a story recently about them safeguarding us from my dad, like literally picking us up from school and taking us to a family member's house and not bringing us to their house specifically because they knew that he was going to come and look for us for a full week. So they were very close to me and mean a lot to me. I wish that they were still here. I really do.
So how would you describe yourself in those school years in Brooklyn, and what kind of,
I was growing up hetero, like growing up as like a black hetero church going extracurricular having girl. Like I said, I have a brother, and so he was doing the sports, and I was doing dance. You know, I would go to, it was literally called the Brooklyn Dance Center, and put on my shiny costumes and dance to Mariah Carey and, like, Michael Jackson songs. I was pretty happy. I was blissfully happy. I had no clue of, like, anything that was going on in the world. I was not a child that was raised, like, politically aware. I was made to believe that being black was fine and that no one had a problem with it. Only people in the South, and we were in the North, so we didn't have to worry about it. Which I was rudely awakened because we moved to New York before 9/11 happened. And so when that took place, ideas of like ethnicity and like social class and like being a citizen or not became really apparent to me, because I saw all of that collide and violence, and it was a very confusing time. I think that's when I woke up, actually, now that I think about it. I started to realize that either if people don't get their way or they feel like they're not listened to, they're going to stand up and do something about it, whether that means that it's going to affect other people. And now that's kind of how I roll. I don't, not saying that I necessarily am a violent person, but I definitely am open to being myself and standing up for people that I believe in, regardless of what is status quo.
There's a couple questions I move beyond, but they're about your parents. What lessons you learned from watching your parents' lives? What kind of work did they do? Gender roles? Any of those aspects?
Okay. That's a lot of questions. So my mom and dad married after my brother was born. He was 2 years old at their wedding. And my dad was a Marine. He actually served in the Vietnam War as a master sergeant. So he was like 15 years older than my mom. She loved that. She also loved the fact that he was assertive and he was willing to provide for her. And, you know, she's told me that when she married him, she knew what she signed up for. She didn't want to go back to work. If she knew the person who created feminism, she would kill them because she wants to be in the kitchen. That type of mentality. My dad, though, was an alcoholic. So his assertiveness coupled with his, like, machismo, he's just, like, Chicago black. Not that he's Spanish, but still that same type of macho mentality made him really angry when he drank. And it was his ritual to drink every day. As soon as he got off of work, he would drive home. The exit of our house there is a corner store with a liquor store. He would stop there every single day, get a bottle, drink it in the maybe 2 miles before he got to our house, and he was already blasted. So that really came to a head, and that's why we moved to New York. So unfortunately, I think one thing that I'm holding on to right now from my parents' relationship is how volatile marriage can be and how destructive it can be if people aren't on the same page, because it can just get to a place where each side is so stubborn. Like, my mom was just so willing to do whatever it was. Like, she was almost stubbornly willing. I don't even know if that's right. And my dad was just so ready to dominate. So we have all these understandings of him now, like thinking about his mental health. He came back from Vietnam, and America hated everyone who came back. They were like, you're baby killers. And so he was dealing with all that stuff. Not to say that it means that, you know, he could be abusive, but he struggled coming in and out of rehab, and I just saw it really tear my mom apart, because she loved him and she still loves him to this day. But it just wouldn't work, and he was not a good father. He was not able to provide for us because of his drinking. There would just be too many secrets and lies, and, you know, he told me he was going to come to my sweet 16. He didn't show up. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. So that's definitely some stuff that I've held on to, and the ideas of gender that I got from my parents was overwhelmingly strict and confined. And so I was raised that way, to think that that was how it was supposed to be. But I also got to see how unhappy they were and how forced it was and unnecessarily complicated. Like, maybe they could have called it quits and led happier lives. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, who were the role models? Are you close with your mother? Or the teachers that you had?
I had one teacher who I called her Mommy Number Two. She was a teacher whose classroom I was in when 9/11 happened. We were in Brooklyn Heights, and it happened in Lower Manhattan. So we were...
See the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. We had a cross on the top of our school, and the first jet flew right over the top of our cross, and we were all shaken because we could feel what was happening and didn't know, and then chaos ensued and debris rained. Her name is Miss Sousa. She's Portuguese and black, like a Brazilian Portuguese woman. So that was my first exposure to that language, and I was really interested in it because I liked the way that she spoke and the way that she interacted with people. So I definitely think she was a role model for about 4 years. My mom and I are close. We've had some strains based on me coming out to her and letting her know that, you know, I'm happy and I love someone and want to be with them, and she's been confused about the severity of it and the ability of it even happening, because she's just Baptist. So the Bible says no. And that's what is most important. So we've had a strained relationship, but my mom has always been a role model for me because she perseveres. I mean, she will do anything to make sure that she has a way to, like, shop and eat and drive a nice car and have a job and travel and laugh and go to concerts. Like, she'll, whatever it means, if she has to put up with some crazy man, she would do that. So that was an interesting way to see that. But she's also so nurturing and still is. There's definitely something about, like, her kiss on the cheek or her, like, hug or her calling you baby or just helping you through a time when you're sick. My other role model is probably my brother. He as strange as it is like a father figure to me. He's only 2 years older, but he was born on my dad's birthday, and he has my dad's name. So he is David Ross Cannon II. And so kind of like reincarnation weirdness happening there. And he's always just been so honest. He works at a boys summer camp, and then they also have camps throughout the year, outdoors, winter camps, where he is a wilderness EMT, and he takes little kids on leadership, like explorations, hiking and canoeing and kayaking. And so whenever I go and visit him, the people like tell me about my brother, like I don't know. And so they're like, no, like Ross, he's really the best guy ever. He's so awesome because he's just real. Like, he'll always be real with you. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's pretty much why I love him. So he's definitely a role model to me.
So what brought you south?
I needed to ground myself, so I came to the south. I am a southern gal. I was born here, and I was taken elsewhere to learn about myself, but I think I needed to return to feel who I really am. So I went to, after New York, I graduated high school, and I went to California. I went to get away from anything East Coast because I was sick of it, and I was like, let me try out LA. Los Angeles, I don't think is for me. I was immediately fed up with people's lack of reality. I felt like no political or social awareness, just living for yourself kind of in a very airheaded way. So I broke down. Like, I literally could not finish college there. I did 2 years and I was like, this isn't working. So I came to Atlanta and I just slept in a closet. I was just like, I don't want to do it. Not doing it. With my mom's help, her like nurturing vibes, I got a job at a mall and I started to like rebuild myself. And then I went to Chapel Hill, and socially it was okay. I made some really good friends who were also transfer students, and so we got along very well, became roommates, and just like had each other's backs through all of it. But I do think that there is a lot of merit in staying in the South because it's a battlegrounds for everything. Like, nothing is given to you here as it is up north or, you know, in the West Coast. Like, you get weed if you go to the West Coast. You get, like, good transportation and 24-hour service in New York. In Atlanta, you get neither one of those. Everything is closed at night. Like, it's not legal here. So I think it's pretty cool to be here in the South.
So did you sort of, in terms of feminism, was that something that came into your life in, through college or?
Yes.
Through individuals?
The concreteness of feminism came into my life in college. I started taking women's and gender studies classes. So I did like women's studies 101, and I had this professor, Karen Booth, who has like purple hair, and she was just so honest and real and didn't care and helped me see that the stuff that I was experiencing was worth studying, and it was not to be discarded. And so that was really exciting and appealing to me. So I quickly got a minor. I was like, I know I'm studying something else here, but let me just grab this up real quick while I'm here for the next 2 years. So I did. But I think that feminism has always been trickling in all the little ways that I interact with people. Like, I've always knew that the way that men catcall women is ridiculous, beyond the fact of just like, this is my body and I don't want to talk to you. But there's other interworkings there, and the reasons why, like, I lived in a neighborhood where my little high school friends didn't want to come to because they were Meryl Streep's daughter or whoever they were, rich and living in Manhattan. They didn't want to come to Bed-Stuy. So I've now realized that, you know, they were used to different socioeconomic, like, norms. They just didn't get it. So it wasn't even like they hated me, but they just couldn't vibe with it because they didn't know. So it's always been there, but feminism became major to me in college, and I don't ever want to live without it.
And also activism, was that something that, doing organizing?
Yeah, I think I started organizing right when Obama got elected in high school, 2008. I was a dancer at that point. I still am a dancer, but the main thing that people knew me as in, like, my high school superlative was, like, best dancer. So I was putting on a dance concert. Like, I made up this dance concert to raise money for Alzheimer's for my grandma. But either way, I gathered all these talented people that I knew. So, like, this one guy who could play the guitar and sing very well. My other friend, Gracie, who can sing and can dance. And at that point, she, like, wasn't that good at dancing, but she was passionate about it, so it didn't matter. And then some of my dance team friends. And then, like, one of my poetry friends, to create this piece on Yes, We Can, because that was Obama's, like, mantra during his 2008 election. So we created that, and that was probably the beginning of me starting to realize that if you pull a bunch of people together and ask them what they think about what's happening in the world, they'll tell you in different ways, and then you can find all these different avenues to connect to other people. So, like, the guy who played guitar, he was good with all the kids who were in, like, music theory. And then the girl who, like, was okay with dancing but was also just passionate about it, she lived in Park Slope. So she had access to really politically open-minded and progressive people that she could tell, like, oh, come and watch me. And then, like, the girls on the dance team, they were just eye candy of, like, the jocks at our school. So they could kind of get in that way. And since then, I've just been moving forward with trying to get to know people and open up ASAP so that they can do the same.
How did it come into the nonprofit work?
So activism into nonprofit work for me probably was because I had a really bad experience with racism. When I was in California, someone decided to write nigger on my door, like, 5 times, and, like, bang my door down and try and intimidate me a little bit. And at that point, I took it to the head. Like, I was like, I'm out here by myself. I don't know who these people are. I don't have any family support here. So let me just go to the police. Let me just go to the headmaster. Let me just go to the dean of students, whatever. And I started to reach out to all those people and saw that corporate entities suck because they don't help. So the police were like, oh, you want to file a harassment complaint? And I was like, yes. And dot, dot, dot. And the dean of students was like, I have an adopted black son, so I get what you're saying, but maybe we should just be quiet about this. And then other...
What college was this?
This is Chapman University in Orange County, California.
Mm-hmm.
Old Town Orange, in fact. So it's like old white money. So, yeah, I just realized at that point that going into corporations and trying to explain my lived experiences was not going to work. I needed to get to some more grounded people and then have them help me, you know, become uplifted. So I started working at like a domestic violence shelter in Orange County, in Orange County in North Carolina, which is Chapel Hill. So it was interesting going from one Orange County to the other. And then I found the Feminist Women's Health Center and felt like I was at home. Like, how much more open-minded do you get than late-term abortion access in the South, not caring about political beliefs, letting you come in with whatever ideas that you have, whatever sexual orientation, gender fluidity, and be yourself and thrive. Mm-hmm. So that was when I started to realize how cool nonprofits are and how I would love to be an executive director of one day.
Were there other issues in college you were working on before I moved into like more the present?
No, it was always abortion. Abortion access.
At UNC?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. UNC had Students United for Reproductive Justice, like a student undergraduate organization. And so I just showed up at some meetings and went to a conference and then started talking a lot more, getting on social media. My Twitter was big. I had a blog at that point too, which was called Make It Nasty. And we just went ham on there about any social issues we felt were nasty, and how we felt like we could change those as young people. I've deleted Make It Nasty now because there was a lot of underage drinking and cursing. But at that point, that was where I started to just talk more about the importance of women having choice and women being able to access abortion and how like 80% of the counties in North Carolina have these fake clinics, these crisis pregnancy centers. And, like, no percentage have abortion clinics. But that was my main thing. Like, I told someone one day, I was like, it sounds weird. Like, you know how they say, like, ranking oppressions. Like, I don't want to rank oppressions. But, like, abortion is over domestic violence for me. It just is any day.
So you kind of did some other work and then came back to the Feminist Women's Health Center.
Mm-hmm.
How did that circle happen?
Yeah, it was really sexist. In between, we're going to school, interning at the Feminist Women's Health Center, kind of being in California where I was oppressed for all these reasons. I was like, let me get a job. Let me just stack some money, and then I will be able to rule the world. So I got a job at Lenox Mall, which is about, I'd say, a mile from here. It is Atlanta's, actually, no, it's not Georgia's biggest mall, but it's Atlanta's main mall. And so it's in the rap songs. It's where people go and stunt. Like, they go and spend $400 on like shoes and hang out. Like, these are grown people, like 35-year-old men who will just stand around and prey on women because they think that is how they will get laid, get famous, get successful and rich. And so I worked at a company called Luxottica, but they own maybe, I think it's 80% of the eyewear industry in the world. So they own like Sears Optical, Sunglass Hut, Lens Crafters, all these other businesses. Mm-hmm. And so we were hired to sell sunglasses. So sunglasses are an accessory. They can help people who have eye disease or cataracts, but they also help people feel like they're better than you. So people will come in and be like, yeah, I want them new Versaces. And they're like $280. And they don't fit your face. Like, you have a square face and you're getting these round glasses. You shouldn't do that. But you think that because you're spending this money, that's good. So working at that place was very much from management supposed to be about appearing sexy, appearing available, appearing ready to serve, like give whatever they needed. Like, you know, we had the glasses that were on display in the case, but people could touch those and try them on. We used to have the glasses that were in the back. And so sometimes the people who were like in the know would come and be like, I don't want those glasses. I want new ones from the back. And then if you didn't have new ones, they were upset because they felt like, I need the better quality. It's so much better. And it's like, no, actually, when my shift ends, I stay here and I clean every single glass, like glass, and I readjust them. And so they're the exact same. But you feel entitled. So people felt entitled a lot at Sunglass Hut. And at first, you know, this is like my first main job. So I'm like, okay, cool. I'm getting attention. This is fun. I'm getting paid. You know, I don't have to worry about spending my money on anyone else. I'm just spending it on getting myself up. So it was good. But then it started to get just more annoying. I didn't even want to go to work because I didn't feel like people hitting on me or like hitting on my coworkers or expecting us to do stupid things, especially when at the same time I'm interning at this clinic where women are trying to get abortion services and can't pay for it or don't have a ride. And so when they get there, they're upset because they actually have these real things going on in their lives. And then I'm at Sunglass Hut and these people are pissed because I don't have a new pair of Versaces, like, mm-hmm. they don't even fit you. So that was Sunglass Hut. That was my transition in between realizing that corporate work, that type of retail work, is not good for me.
So what's your work now? What's your position? What's your day like?
Mm-hmm. So my weekdays and my weekends are different from each other. My weekdays consist of working in our advocacy and empowerment network. So that's our downstairs area where we have a variety of different staff members work on like policy or political engagement activities. So for example, I work for the Black Women's Wellness Program, and so that's creating a program where women who receive abortion services or need health insurance or just want to talk about sexual health can come and say, listen, I'm having these problems. I really need someone to talk to. I need a community. And so we set them up with like, you know, five or six other women, have them come together, talk about it. Now they have a network. We do a lot of tabling and festivals. We go to the Black communities, which in Atlanta are the Old Fourth Ward and the West End. They're both historically Black and still look Black. I mean, just looking at like statistics, like the West End has about 18,000 residents, 89% of those are Black, 11 Caucasian. It's like literally Black, white. So it's a really interesting neighborhood. And then the Old Fourth Ward, which is where I live, is being gentrified. And so Black people are getting pushed out. But that's the program that I work for. We have other stuff that happens downstairs, like we have a Lifting Latina Voices initiative, which is a completely Latina program. So the women do sexual health outreach. They do like house parties where the promotoras, who are the health promoters, go and just talk about these different disparities that face Hispanic women. Like, they don't talk about sex. because your abuela does not talk about sex, and you're not going to have it, but you're having it, you know? Oops. Right. So things like that. We have a lot of volunteer outreach. That's my weekdays. The weekends, I'm up in the clinic, and so that's in the same building, just on a different floor. And that's where we provide our gynecological care services. So our main one on weekends is abortion. We do up to 23.6 weeks. And so that means that we take the women through all the stages. They come in our door pregnant, they leave not pregnant. So whatever that takes. So that means that they need to speak with a health educator and talk through their decision and work with their family to have them understand why they're making this decision. We help them do that. If they have a fetal anomaly, so the fetus is not viable or will not live outside of the womb, we help them find a way to kind of cope with that and undergo surgery in order to not have to deal with that anymore. Also, if women are, you know, coming to us because they've been raped, helping them feel like they have a place that is safe for them to access these services where their perpetrator won't come and find them or know what they did or ask any questions. Yeah, it's just like a safe haven, and it's really cool. I love working there. We are such a close-knit family that when someone leaves to like go back to school or for a new job, it's really sad because we experience so much together that we can't really explain to other people. So they're like, oh, how do you know her? And I'm like, she's my coworker, but like, she's my family. Like, we hold people's lives and make sure that they're breathing and that they're happy and not crying and are realizing that this is their choice. They don't have to be stigmatized about it. If this is something that they need or want to do, we can do it safely. So let's do it. Like, so that's my weekends, which generally are very chaotic and unknown hours. So it's just like I'll go at 6 a.m. and whatever time I get off, whatever time the last patient's out the door and we've cleaned up, that's when we go. Otherwise, I'm just there. Our doctors are awesome. They're Emory doctors, and they really care about women's lives and are willing to do whatever it means, like at the state capitol, to make sure that women can access abortion, which I think is really important for the actual medical professionals to be advocates for this service, because sometimes, actually a lot of times, more so than not, the medical professionals just do what they have to do, walk out the door and pretend like it never happened because they don't want to, you know, be scrutinized or impose danger on their families, which I understand. But for the future of abortion access, it's so critical right now. We're like 40 years away from it being legal. Like, it's been that way since the 70s, but we're like, I don't want to put a number on it, but less years of it possibly not being legal because states are just moving back and back and back and making sure that women are denied access. Even this most recent Planned Parenthood stuff that's been going on, the implications or accusations that they sell fetal parts, which is ridiculous and impossible because you can't mail that shit, like, someone has to pick it up and put it in a refrigerator. But those implications have had a lot of, I guess, effect on our clinic. Like, the other day, the state and health inspectors came to our clinic just unannounced. Just were like, we're here to just check on the fetal tissue remains and just make sure that you don't have any. Like, what? We don't even do that. Like, yeah, we actually don't. It's not a part of the services we provide. Like, you can't go to Wendy's and ask them about their fish bones. They don't have fish with bones. They just have one little fish sandwich, you know? Like, it just, it doesn't, it's not right. It doesn't make sense. So that's been very hard for us to deal with because we want to provide access for women, but these barriers keep coming up and it makes it even more alienating for us to always be the ones who are defensive. So we go to the Capitol and we try and be as offensive or offensive as possible. But it always just sounds like we're trying to do something wrong, unfortunately.
The language of the right makes it sound like to be defensive.
Yeah.
The next question is, what keeps you up at night? But I think this is sort of...
money. Working in a nonprofit does not mean financial security. Mm-hmm. Can't get no raises. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next set of questions are sort of different issues that have happened and how they've sort of impacted you, the organization you work for. So I'm just going to more read them than I was. And some of them you've already brought up a little bit, but how would you say the economic crash of 2008 affected you or your organization?
For me, it meant that my mom lost a job. It meant that my dad was further emotionally depressed and sick. For feminists, the Feminist Women's Health Center, I don't know, I didn't exist with them yet, but I'm sure that it hit them in the same way that we get hit now when, you know, that time every year when you need to renew your budget and you're waiting for the Ford Foundation money to come in. I'm sure it was a really hard time for feminists. Indeed.
Yeah. So do funding issues, are they a central concern in the
organization? Oh, yeah. Yeah, for us and for our women. So sliding scale fees, we're a nonprofit, so we can provide services from, I'd say, anywhere $400 to $2,000. No, $400 to $4,000. Abortion gets expensive for the women. So most women can't pay $4,000 all of a sudden. Like, you kind of just have to help them see that they're rational. Like, it's okay. We're listening and we're here. Mm-hmm. You are making the right choice for yourself if you think you are. If you don't think you are, leave now. Like, so money is a big deal for the women. We give a lot of discounts. So depending on if they're a student or if they're in the military or if they have some type of health insurance or if they have Medicaid, we can help out with that a little bit. As far as the organization goes with funding, we have our main funders that have been supporters of us for at least the past 15 years. We've been around for about 40 years total now. But some of them drop off at different times, mm-hmm. not because they don't want to support our organization, but because they realize there's so much need. So whereas maybe 5 years ago we could have gotten more money to talk about abortion stigma, now there's a lot of organizations trying to do it and so desperately needing the money. It's just like, who sounds more desperate in their letter?
It sounds like you create support networks and are creating relationships that are ongoing.
Yeah. In the South. The South is already like a world of its own. So I feel like we bring... But the point is that funding definitely is an issue for most abortion clinics because we don't get any state funding. We just get scrutinized and harassed. So the little monies that we do have, we try and reallocate to the women to make their lives better and to enrich their experience. So it's hard to also pay people, like to keep right. people happy. Like, you got to pay for health insurance for people because that's also a feminist kind of mentality. Like, how are you going to have an organization without health insurance?
For staff.
Yeah.
Staff health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But as an intern, for example,
You don't get shit. That's an unpaid labor.
Yeah.
Like, our clinic vibes off that unpaid labor. Unfortunately, it's kind of creepy. I shouldn't say creepy. Don't put creepy in there.
Stricken for the record. It's a nonprofit wide custom.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I don't know the idea is that there would be a position like that you found.
Yeah.
To get paid at some point for at a place you want to be at.
Yes. It is definitely a stepping stone to work at a clinic. And so there are other things that you get. Like, you're on a course. You're at school when you're at the clinic. Like, you're learning all these things. The same things that people are learning in their human anatomy classes, you're getting in real time. So you get a lot of stuff out of interning at women's health clinics, but it's just not money.
Mm-hmm. This might seem like... the recent past, I don't need to read it, but this question's about, you know, the racialized violence that's been going on forever, but in the last couple of years in the media, and how, or horrific events have brought racialized violence to the forefront of people's minds. How have you engaged with these conversations through your work? How have they shaped your organization's approach?
Totally. I'm Black. I live in the South. I'm passionate about Black people thriving. Atlanta is generally thought of as this place where it's like the Black Mecca. Like, it's all these Black people and they seem to be doing good. But it's also a place where white people really want to resist it. So they do small things. The most recent thing that has really bothered me took place in Conyers, which is about 45 minutes from here. KKK members were just putting flyers on people's driveways and cars, like recruiting for more members. And it wasn't necessarily in neighborhoods that were Black, but it was just like, yo, we need to up our people because these Black people are coming out and talking about all the injustices. It made the news for a hot second, but was not something that was deemed important or of alert by our governor or our mayor. Our governor is white. Our mayor is Black. So even within that kind of construct, I feel like our mayor has to put up with a lot of hushing. Like, he can't really side with Black people at the end of the day. Like, he'll lose his job. So that's been really frustrating to me. I have marched a couple of times in the past 3 months. For different causes that have to do with either Black women being beaten or Black men experiencing unnecessary violence or being killed. I took my mom with me recently and we marched and it was awesome. We wore all white. It's definitely at the forefront of my everyday. I mean, today was a really hard one for me because there are new, I'm going to call them truths, about Sandra Bland being dead in her mugshot,
really?
Which I believe is true. The way that the angle of the picture is, you can see up her nose, which you really only see if someone's laying down. They also have it side by side with photos of her just like taking selfies in the past 3 weeks because she was alive 3 weeks ago, where you just see her straight on. You can't see up her nose. Her eyes are alive, even if she's stressed. I mean, she was a social activist. She always talked about police brutality. And so looking at other things with that, like the background of her is this deep gray. And looking at another picture of an inmate, another mugshot of an inmate at the same time who was booked, they have like a popcorn wall on him with like a crevice in the wall. I don't know how to explain it. Like a concrete wall painted over light gray. And then there's a picture of the cell that she was in. And you can see that the wall is light gray concrete. You can see that the floor is dark gray. So her being there, seeing up her nose with a dark gray background, looking like there's nothing in her eyeballs, was really hard for me to like go through today. So luckily, working at a place like Feminist, we're talking about those things. We're on them, and it's not like, all right, everyone, close your Facebook. Don't check that until after work. It's like, no, post something right now. Like, make sure you retweet this, sign this petition, and tell other people too. So it's actually been helpful for me working at that type of organization, because I don't have to hold on to it all day. But at the same time, it's really hard for our organization to stand up for so many things at once. Abortion access in the South is already such a taboo topic, to then also bring in like police brutality is just too much. Also bring in like economic access and the need for funding is extra. So it's a lot of strains on top of our organization, but I'm committed to it. So whatever.
Shows that I've been away from social media
for 7 hours.
Yeah, because I saw the edited video.
Yeah.
Of the police car video, and there's like the same
white car or truck or whatever. Yeah. And that's interesting. That's why social media is that shit. Like, you can't, you almost can't get away from it, because you're like, these are kind of important things, and these are exciting discoveries that people are realizing because they just look and see. Like, before it was just, you just didn't know. It was like, oh, it's in that building. I'm outside of that building. I don't know what's happening. But with social media, it's like, no, I have a picture of the bathroom. I have a picture of me in the elevator. I have a picture of me over here. Like, let's compile these things and see what's actually happening. So social media is interesting.
Yeah. How would you say that shapes your work?
Social media is important when we're trying to reach out to organizations. So building credibility, showing that we support these types of issues, telling people about things. We are the source of information for a lot of people because they work in corporate environments or wherever, and then they go home and they scroll and they're like, thanks, Feminist. Like, now I know what's happening.
And I mean, you have, so you've had Twitter since college, or you're kind of positioned at the place where there's other people in nonprofits trying to catch up or figure things out, but you're coming of age with it, you know.
I did come of age with a lot of social media outlets, and it's cool. I enjoy it, but I also have a deep hatred for everyone knowing everything about everyone at all times. I have a lot of social media pet peeves, like people who check in every single place they go. I'm like, they literally have it configured to know where you are. But social media is powerful too, because it gets you across the world. I have been able to become a part of a Women of Color Sexual Health Network, which is women all over the United States who do any type of work like this. And it's really good to look up. Actually, that'll give you a lot of people to talk with.
Is that what it's called?
Yep. Women of Color Sexual Health Network. So it's WOCSHN. There's a website, and it has all of our bios and what we do and where we are. So it's helped me see that people are experiencing the same types of bullshit in different places, and how if we actually talk to each other, we might be able to do something about it. Whereas if we just felt like we were isolated here, then we might not be able to make as much of a stink, because we can compare ourselves to other places. I think that social media is powerful in positive ways too.
It seems like part of the strategy is to disconnect clinics, isolate clinics, so they're connected into kind of a network. There's less isolation.
Oh, yeah.
Do you worry, I mean, are there, there's a question that's, what are special challenges that social media raises, but it makes me wonder about, you know, you don't list your phone numbers on the website. There's a certain level of security you guys have sort of decided to use. So how does that work with social media?
Yeah. Social media is also a place of harassment for us. So we have to be really careful with how we respond to trolls and how we are vigilant with who gets access to our files. Like, hackers are real, so they try and do what they can to shut us down at all times. So being careful with our password chains, and if we log into something, making sure we log out. Whereas in other places, you just might not have to worry as much. Like, literally, none of us are allowed to really have our cell phones die. And it's not, you would kind of think it would be the opposite in most workplaces, like they don't want you on your phone, but like, we always need to have our phone in case something happens. Like, of course, we can intercom through the building, but for whatever reason, it's like extra safety to make sure that everyone can get in touch with everyone at whatever time is necessary, especially in the time where right now we're having a lot of extra scrutiny and protesters.
Outside.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'll get to see tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sometimes the church will bring certain people. So if they're not there when you get there, they're on their way. Like, it's kind of weird. But I think they're lame. You know, had a lot of protesters in New York when I lived there and saw them at the Planned Parenthood's there. They had really graphic signs and were screaming curse words and trying to not let you walk in physically. And here they're just like, please, can we help you? So I think they're pretty lame.
They're not good. Those pictures are so... They graphic. Have that in UMC, like the last couple of years, people show up with the big board pictures.
Yeah, that was like my like claim to fame on Chapel Hill. Like, I shut them hoes down. Like, let me stop. I shut the Genocide Awareness Project down. Like, I was just like, there's no way you will be on our campus. I literally protested for, or counter protested for 2 days straight. Because it was
standing
ridiculous.
In front of them?
Standing in front of them with a bullhorn and signs, throwing condoms at all students, giving, like, we created a safe space over by Dye Hall. There's, like, some, like, where, like, the Caudill Laboratories is, like, over in that space. We created a little space with, like, balloons and blankets and coloring books and, like, finger paints and nail polish and, like, yummy food, so that if people were feeling triggered by seeing that, they could just go be isolated from it. Those people, the Genocide Awareness Project, are really relentless with their decision to display graphic stuff. I taught sex ed at that point to sixth graders, and they happened to come on a field trip to UNC's campus that day. So they saw the stuff, and it had an effect on them that was really negative, which further pissed me off and made me stay longer. So, yeah.
Maybe you can come back every do that.
I know, that would be cool. That would be a field trip. I'd be totally down.
Camp.
Yeah. It's a good idea.
Recently, how does the LGBT rights movement affect your organization or intersect with that work? And then conversations of sexuality, sexual identity, trans issues shape it.
So, the Feminist Women's Health Center provides comprehensive gynecological care to all who need it without judgment. We support who I call my rainbow family, like whatever it is you feel in your body, we support it. So we have a trans health initiative, and that's run by this awesome guy who does a lot of workshops. He does like a trans 101 workshop where he talks about, like, don't say tranny. Like, don't spell trans woman like this. Spell it like that. Don't say what is a trans. So he does those kind of fundamental things. And then he also works a lot at the Capitol. So we have been, as an organization, really excited about this new federal ruling that people can marry whoever they want. And it's important for my relationship because we've experienced a lot of hatred from, or confusion and hatred from our families because they're very conservative. And so kind of having this federal truth is exciting for us. I just, via networking, was able to speak with Mary Bonato's, like, partner, her wife, who argued the case. Like, she's one of the three people who did. So that was really cool, and that helped me see that at whatever level it is you need, it's important to have marriage equality, and people care about it, and people are interested in it, and it's so obviously okay. Atlanta is also known as, like, a black gay mecca. Like Black Gay Pride here is literally 7 days long, and it's kind of like a fuck you to just regular pride. So it's extra long, but it's also fun. Like, it's also good. We're about to go this year. It's going to be good.
When is it?
It's September 2nd through 9th. Yeah. And it's going to be fun. You should come. So, marriage equality federally is really exciting. Like, the day that it happened, we were both at work, and so we were, like, on that grind, but we were like, okay, once we get off work, this is going to be cool. So we met up at this burger spot with, like, one of our super accepting friends who's, like, overly emotional but also might have some, like, social disorders and is, like, hyperactive. So she was ready to go. Like, she was already, like, fit for it. So we went to this burger spot, and I get there before Tiffany gets there. And I have my flowers. Aww. And my cupcakes, right? Rainbow cupcakes, of course. And then she shows up, and she has the same flowers, like, from the same store. And they were called, like, freedom flowers. And she had a balloon, that little balloon right there that says thank you. And so then we were, like, super vibing off of that, and we were happy, and we were, like, eating burgers and, like, drinking $4 margaritas, and someone walks up to us, and they're like, what are you celebrating? And we're like, equality. And the whole restaurant just, like, cheers. It's like, wow. Yeah! And we're like, this is awesome. This is really fun. This is cool. It's also helped my mom come around a lot. She had some elevated levels of homophobia, and now they are decreased. I can, I mean, you slept at my house recently, take care of my dog, like, we go places, I tell her where I'm at. So it's had a lot of implications that will continue to evolve, I think, mm-hmm. because people are just realizing, like, oh, I can't be racist anymore. Okay, I won't be racist. Oh, I can't be homophobic. I won't be homophobic. So I'm excited about it. And our organization is, too. Like, the day that it happened, people at work were just like, cool, congrats. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's just a few questions left. And then sort of the political climate we've talked about. What does it mean to have Obama in the White House shaping this time? If at all, it says. Comma, if at all.
I'm glad it says if at all. Barack Obama, 2 terms as President of the United States, has been good for immigrant families. They've been able to get driver's licenses, health insurance, and just live a little bit more securely, they think. It's also been really negative for immigrant families. Like, there have been so many people deported and so many people held in, like, detention centers and unable to get just basic things that they need. Obama's 2 terms for women has also meant that he put a really strong Black woman in the forefront of everyone. Like, she was doing public speaking events. She was coming. She had her own little, like, get healthy campaign. He put 2 little, Black girls also as admirable. Now, younger Black girls have role models, and that's huge. But at the same time, he's never once spoken about the importance of, like, matriarchs or not beating on women or defending abortion access. He just doesn't. But I kind of understand it. He really can't rock the boat right now. Like, there's just been too much conservative whiteness for all these years that he feels like he can't do it. He just needs to slowly make these changes. But, you know, how the federal government works, there are other people who have a lot of power, and they are very, very conservative, known as Congress, the Supreme Court. So he kind of is really limited in the things that he can really do. I mean, he tries. So I think that he wants to get out of his 2 terms as unscathed. I think he wants to be alive, which I really, really understand. Having a Black brother, having, you know, being a Black woman, I understand how much of a target you are with anything that you do, especially if you stand out in any other way. So I get that security is a big concern to him.
No, but I think you really said a lot of the, like, this is true and this is true, kind of, about his presidency. So next question's about third wave. Feminism. Do you identify with the third wave terminology? Why or why not? What does it mean to you? Or how do you think about yourself in relation to this history of feminism?
I say get with the waves. I don't love it, but just do it. Like, just stop trying to hinder our movement. Let us gain some shit. Like, you know, let us have some credibility. So I'm fine with people, mm-hmm. you know, deeming me as being in the third wave. I was at some meeting recently at Spelman College with my colleague, Kwajalein, who you'll talk with. You're going to love her. She's awesome. And the students were leading the meeting, so the icebreaker question was, tell your name and what kind of feminist you are. And so some people started off with, like, hi, I'm Sarah. I think I'm just, like, a regular feminist. And I was like, hi, I'm Susie. I think that, like, I'm a womanist. And everyone's like, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, womanist. Okay, yeah. And then the other one's like, yeah, you know, I'm Latina. Like, you know, I'm really Chicana feminismo and, like, whatever. And then I was just like, I'm just parking. I'm a feminist. Like, chill. Like, whatever we are, we're all in this. We're all in the same time period, though. So let's just move on with it. Like, yeah. It's good to, you know, identify with certain struggles. But then you get back to the oppression Olympics, and that's annoying, and saying that, like, well, white feminism really doesn't get to the root of, like, intersectionality. No, it doesn't, but it's white feminism. Let it chill. Like, intersectionality goes ham. Yes, it does. Like, it talks about all these intersections of race and class and, you know, all of that, which is great, but that doesn't mean that white feminists suck or you're better. I'm fine with the third wave mentality. I think that other people are not, though, and it's kind of interesting to me how there's always the big stink, specifically in women of color organizations, to be okay with the wave mentality. But I'm fine with it. It's interesting to try and quantify it and then also shut it down at the same time. But I think that speaks to also just the ideology around not letting go of the movement until you feel like people got it and will really catch it. So a lot of times it's been like, you know, no, like, this is second wave feminism because we believe this and this is how we roll and y'all don't get it yet, so you don't get the torch yet. But I think it's evolving naturally, and we should just be happy that people are interested.
Yeah, like at that Spelman workshop or whatever, what were the next question is, what are the biggest challenges facing feminists today, facing activists? So
not being killed.
Yeah,
for real though, death is real. We already like spoke about Sandra Bland, but like men too, people who just are relentless and are honest, like really open their eyes and see what's happening in their communities and don't like it, are a threat. It's interesting though, because people who are more extreme are considered less of a threat. So people who openly kill people, like the dude in fucking South Carolina who just went into a church and just shot up all these random old black people. It's not a good way to explain it, sorry. But okay. The point that I'm making is that this person was an extremist, and he's not considered as much of a threat as someone who is every day posting on social media about police brutality, like Sandra. And so for activists, it's really just feeling like you're safe in being honest. A lot of the different hashtags that keep coming up are just so honest. It's just like, if I was in police custody, or the one where, I can't remember what the hashtag was, but it was basically like showing which picture would they show of me if I was killed. They're just so real, and so they come naturally and they keep occurring, but officials really don't like it, so it's hard for us to be loud and then be safe at the same time.
do you think the housing issues going on in either here or sort of, I just put it as to the side, gentrification, you know, because I was moving to the south from New York, it felt like there was a housing crisis going on, it's intense. Do you think that plays into the work that you do?
Yeah, a lot of people call us a lot of times and are like, hey, do you have transitional housing? Hey, do you know how I can get, like, to a homeless shelter? Hey, you know, questions about housing all the time. The neighborhood I live in, the Old Fourth Ward, has the largest concentration of Section 8 housing in the Southeast. That's big. And at the same time, food deserts and no jobs. And so housing plays into a big part of the work that we do indirectly. We work with a Section 8 housing leasing office called Bedford Pines. It's on Boulevard. And Boulevard is like the center of the Black community in the Old Fourth Ward. It's like, I'm off Boulevard. I'm close to Boulevard. I'll see you on Boulevard. Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally just called Boulevard Northeast. Or, mm-hmm. like, Boulevard Southeast. Women definitely experience a lot of violence in those Section 8 houses, too. I've talked with a good deal of women who feel really unsafe where they live, but it's their only option. And wish that they could do something else, and so that's why they come to us and hope that we have some, like, silver lining. Unfortunately, we don't, because we don't work with, like, the Nicholas House or whatever other transitional organizations, but we try as much as we can to just empower them to get the other parts of their lives as positive as possible and then find housing. Feeling unsafe where you live rocks your world. I lived in Bed-Stuy for a long time in my life, and you can't go home. Like, you get off a train and you're like, okay, now I have to worry about something. Or you want to leave at a certain time, you have to worry about something. You want to wear something and you have to think about what type of harassment you're going to get. So it's of major concern, and I definitely think that it's something that should be incorporated into, like, policies to make sure that people have safe housing.
What are your hopes, dreams for the future of feminism?
Aww, hopes, dreams. I hope that abortion access is considered vital to the feminist movement's future. I also hope that we have someone in office who says feminism out loud once a day on a microphone. I also hope that more men begin identifying as feminists and start realizing that it's not a term just for women. I also hope that feminism is nurturing and is kind. My brother even said to me, when I told him I was taking, like, a women's studies class, was like, oh, you're gonna be one of those mad, angry feminists. I hate that. And, you know, in some regards, I hear what he's saying. I think that we have a right to be angry, and I will always defend myself as an angry Black woman. But at the same time, I want it to be gentle with its people. Like, I want it to open up self-care networks. I want it to show women that, like, hey, use a menstrual cup. Don't use a pad. Like, use a rag. Just chill. Like, take a bath. you're not bleeding that much. Like, you're really not. So I wanted to be kind to the people who subscribe to it. And what else do I want? I want it to be fun. Like, let's go out drinking and dancing. Let's go out, like, celebrating. Let's dress up nicely if we want to. Let's not. Let's protest. Let's look beautiful. Let's look sad and angry. Yeah, I want feminism to be fun. Also want to throw up Who Needs Feminism again, because that was how I got my start with open mics. Also want to talk a little bit about speaking publicly about your abortion experience. There's something called the Abortion Diaries, founded by Melissa Madera, who is relentless in collecting abortion stories and has a podcast on SoundCloud. And it's not political at all. She doesn't ask you any questions. She just turns on a recorder, tells you she loves you, and says, talk about your abortion experience. Start wherever you want, end wherever you want. Of course, want to talk a little bit about Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Justice, which is where I've found that women of color are strong and collectively can do a lot of mobilizing, which is headed up by Monica Simpson. She is absolutely a role model to me, and she's beautiful inside and out. Also want to throw up Stacey Ann Chin because she's cool as fuck, and I got to drive her around in my car, and she has a new play with Cynthia Nixon, who was on Sex and the City. She was Miranda, who's actually a lesbian. Oh my god. And also want to throw up Sex and the City because that's my favorite show, even though it's ridiculous.
Are you on the board for Sister Song?
I am right now.
What's I'm going to like?
3 years. It's a lot of telecommunicating. So people are everywhere, and that's the point of Sister Song. So people are in D.C., Arizona, California, New Mexico, New York, Georgia, Texas. That's just me thinking off the top of my head. And so it's a place where we, like, connect in with each other, and we're like, hey, this is happening here. This is really messed up. We need some memes. We need some money. We need some t-shirts, and then kind of send it all that way or send it this way. Because women of color is such an all-encompassing term that it's like, I'm black. I can't talk about what Native American women experience in New Mexico. I have no fucking clue. I'll pretend like I do if you'll pay me. But I don't know. So it's important to get those experiences.